Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Heard all over the state on Utah Public Radio, I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, pedestrian deaths near the new South Salt Lake homeless shelter lead to a call for safety improvements. Also, the father-son team working to make a difference in the lives of people who are homeless by listening. A look at the past decade in health trends in Utah. And a columnist peers into the mists to predict the news of the year ahead. Joining me for this conversation, we've got Salt Lake Tribune reporter Jessica Miller. Good morning, and thanks for being here, Jessica.
Good morning.
Also, reporter Taylor Stevens, thanks for being here as well, Taylor. Good morning.
Good morning.
And news columnist Robert Gerke, welcome to you as well.
Good morning. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. And listeners, you are invited to join this discussion. You can call 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK, or you can tweet your questions and comments to us. Our handle is at KCPW. All right, it's the first week of a new year, and you'd think that the news would take a break and let us all rest, but apparently that's not the case. And Taylor Stevens, you covered two items related to homelessness this week. One had to do with some tragic events near to the new Homeless Men's Resource Center, which is in South Salt Lake. A few auto pedestrian accidents since the shelter moved in. Tell us what happened there. How many accidents are we talking about?
So there's been three fatal accidents since the resource center opened in November. The first happened just a few weeks after it opened. The second happened on Christmas Day when a car hit and killed a man in a wheelchair. And the third happened the day after that, last Friday, when a man, a 67-year-old man, was crossing and killed while walking across multiple lanes of traffic.
Were all three of these men experiencing homelessness and seeking shelter?
Police have said they believe they were trying to get to the Homeless Resource Center, which is located in sort of an out-of-the-way area that's been a problem for many homeless men. The resource centers have a transportation kind of plan right now where they are taking men from one resource center to another and also to the Wiegand Center. But if you are, you know, trying to get there by yourself, maybe you're walking, it's outside the free fare zone, you don't want to get a ticket, then it's kind of a difficult location to get to, and it's a heavy traffic area. So those have both been problems, as well as if you take the bus stop is not located near the kind of near the crosswalk. And so what they believe is that a lot of people have been kind of just crossing rather than backtracking to get to the intersection to get to the crosswalk, have been kind of jaywalking across the street instead.
You mentioned the fact that it's outside of the free fare zone, and so people might walk there because they don't want to get a ticket for riding transit for free. Can you just actually remind us where the South Salt Lake shelter is? It's in South Salt Lake, obviously, but where? What are the coordinates?
Yeah, let me give you the exact address, which I don't have off the top of my head, but about 33rd South and 10th West. So that has been a challenge, again, being outside of the free fare zone. But, you know, in light of these crashes, the South Salt Lake City Councilwoman Corey Thomas has been calling for some safety improvements, as has the service provider, the Road Home, which operates the shelter. Corey Thomas would like to see the speed limit reduced from 45 to 35 in the area near the shelter, to put a crosswalk closer to the shelter, and to move the bus stop to be closer to the intersection.
Can I ask, in your article, you pointed out that the shelter managers or the managers of the parent organization of the shelter actually put their own crosswalk in at one point but had to take it away. Can you tell us why?
Yeah, so this has been a kind of a battle on the location. South Salt Lake has not wanted the shelter to be located here. They've noted it's far from services, that it's in an agricultural area. And so they have sort of had this conditional use permit where they outlined all of the challenges with this location. And so I remembered reading that, and I thought I read something about the transportation piece. So I went back and looked at it, and it turns out they were aware of the need for safety improvements in this area before they issued the conditional use permit to Shelter the Homeless, which owns the three homeless resource centers. And one of their requirements for issuing the permit was that Shelter the Homeless work to put a lighted crosswalk at 33rd and 10th as soon as possible. The Shelter the Homeless said that it had painted a crosswalk at that area, but had to paint back over it because it doesn't own the road. The Utah Department of Transportation does. And the Utah Department of Transportation said that it needed to do a traffic study before it could put in a lighted crosswalk. And so, you know, this isn't a surprise in some ways. This is a dangerous area, a dangerous intersection. And it's been known that there needed to be some improvements, and those weren't made in a timely fashion, and people lost their lives.
People lost their lives, and I mean, crossing the street where there isn't a crosswalk. You wrote, I mean, you're talking about jaywalking there and people experiencing homelessness. You, not that long ago, wrote about the disproportionate number of jaywalking citations in the Salt Lake City area that homeless residents get as opposed to the rest of us. And again, these are people trying to get to shelter. The people who were hit by cars and killed, they may have been jaywalking, but there's probably more to that story than just the fact that, you know, their jaywalking led to them dying, because people seeking shelter, people who are experiencing homelessness, have a host of other factors in you know, the decisions that they're making. I'm kind of rambling here, Kelly,
I think, but there are, you know, some advocates who would argue that if people are using the road this way, that roads are made as much for pedestrians as they are for cars. And if people need to use the road this way, that there should be some changes made so that people can do that safely. Hmm. It's, I think, easy to say, you know, just to go to the crosswalk. How many of us have, you know, not done that to save a few minutes of time? I think a lot of us have, is something that we, you know, found when we were doing our work into jaywalking. But the South Salt Lake Police Department is increasing jaywalking enforcement in this area, which they hope will make people safer. This is an area that has been identified as a problem with jaywalking. However, you know, as we have pointed out in our past reporting, jaywalking tickets do sometimes disproportionately impact people experiencing homelessness, at least in Salt Lake City. And those tickets can carry fines of up to $750, which can be a steep cost for somebody who is experiencing homelessness and doesn't have a permanent address, has trouble engaging in the criminal justice system. So it's a more complex issue, I think, than it appears on kind of first glance, that these, you know, three deaths in this area, it's very complex and has a lot to do with all of the structures that these people have to kind of work through to get basic shelter.
Okay. Robert Gerke, you're the news columnist in the room. And before we move on to another and maybe more uplifting story that that Taylor wrote this week on homelessness, do you have any thoughts on this one, just on these deaths and maybe even where the South Salt Lake shelter is? I don't know.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you think about where the shelter is, as Taylor mentioned, it's not a pedestrian friendly area. There's not a lot of you know, in terms of sidewalks, crosswalks, that sort of thing, stoplights along that stretch. And it's traffic moves fast there. I mean, as she mentioned, 45 is the speed limit. If you've ever driven it, I think 55 is more common. And setting aside the fact that people are homeless, if you're going to have a big increase or an anticipated influx in pedestrian traffic in that area, there should have been steps taken to try to accommodate that, homeless or not. And so the fact that you know, this has been in the works for a long time now, and they still haven't got these safety features in place to try to make sure that people can get to and from this shelter in a safe fashion, I think is really unfortunate, and kind of speaks again to an issue we've talked about here on the show before, about sort of the haphazard, seat of the pants way that a lot of these homeless services have been rolled out, particularly in South Salt Lake, and partly because, as Taylor mentioned, there were delays in getting this one open. So it needs to be taken care of. It needs to be taken care of fast. And I think that probably is going to require some cooperation with UDOT. If I'm right, it's a state road there on 35th South.
Right.
And the city and the Shelter of the Homeless to all come together and try to get this done, because it's not going to get better on its own. So there needs to be some action taken with some urgency.
And then, you know, we're not even talking about the number of available beds or the rest of the homeless sort of picture here in Salt Lake City. I do want to, Taylor, actually turn now to another story that you covered this past week. which is about some people who are trying to find a way to make a difference in the lives of Salt Lake City's homeless population. And it's a father-son duo, and they have this simple way of connecting with people, food and conversation. Who are they, and what are they doing, Taylor?
Yeah, John and Chase Hansen, as you said, father and son. Chase is 10 and from Taylorsville. John lives in Draper. And they started this a few years back as kind of a community engagement project. Chase would see people experiencing homelessness and asked his dad, you know, what's going on? Why are these people, you know, why don't they have homes? What can we do to help? What do they need? And John said, well, I'm not sure. I'm not an expert on homelessness. Why don't we ask them? And so they started working with people experiencing homelessness. At first, they kind of did some engagement where they would pass out food at the parks. But that didn't really have the effect that they wanted of actually getting to know people and learning their stories. And so what they started doing is inviting people to sit down with them and have a meal with them, 30 minutes to an hour, kind of sit down. And what they do is kind of different than what a lot of people who are talking to people experiencing homelessness do. They try to ask what John calls the innocent questions. So, you know, a 10-year-old coming up, and he wants to know things like, what's your favorite color? What's your dream job? If you could live anywhere, you know, where would it be? Hawaii, you know, China, where would you want to live? And so it's much less focused on, you know, what are the problems that got you here? Do you do drugs? Are you, you know, did you get evicted? It's not trying to identify a problem. They're just trying to get to know the person. And so that's kind of how it began, and it's sort of since merged into a low-profit, limited liability company called Project Empathy, and they're trying to train other groups to do this. They've worked with some church groups. They are trying to engage right now with some city leaders, and so it's sort of just growing from its origins.
I mean, right, so this is this is a father and son, you know, going out, having a conversation, no judgment, these innocent questions, as you said. Beyond the single meal and the venue for connecting with people that a lot of people on the streets and, you know, also people off the streets don't have, how else are they helping the people? I mean, is there a further initiative after that, or is it just the, you know, acknowledging the person's humanity, having a conversation for that half hour and giving them a meal?
The acknowledgement of a person's humanity, I think, is kind of the first piece of it. And for a lot of the people they meet with, that's all that it is. But there are a number of folks who they've connected with on this deeper level who they've sort of helped through some processes. So they helped at least one homeless man get into housing. They helped him with his housing applications and just kind of, you know, being a shoulder to lean on, transportation, social security applications. So some of the, and I believe it's mostly men, the people they've ended up kind of mentoring, but they've mentored kind of a few and helped them through the process to try and get them into housing. And some of those are people who are chronically homeless in other parts of the valley. We talk a lot about Salt Lake City, but they worked with a man, for example, who was living behind a Lucky's in West Jordan. So they also connect with people who are kind of across the valley because they live, you know, further south.
What's a Lucky's?
It's a new kind of grocery store.
Okay, thanks. Sorry. you know, this actually ties into that last story that we were talking about, and you mentioned that they've been having conversations with city officials. They've had some conversations with South Salt Lake, where the new Men's Resource Center is. What were those conversations like? I mean, this father-son duo had these conversations.
Yeah, so they met with South Salt Lake leaders. The idea just being that, as we mentioned, South Salt Lake now has at least 300 new residents. South Salt Lake has put up a little bit of opposition, city leaders, to having this resource center there, because South Salt Lake has, you know, more impactful services than other cities, and they felt it wasn't fair. But now it's there, and so John and Chase want to say, how can we help these residents who have been a little skeptical about this being located in their city? How can we help them connect with these people experiencing homelessness and sort of get to know their humanity and maybe get a little bit more comfortable with the idea of, you know, their new neighbors, get to know their new neighbors on a deeper level?
Robert Gerke, columnist. This Taylor story came out right after Christmas, a moment in time when a lot of people are feeling especially giving and charitable, but this father and son team are working year-round to try to make a difference, and that's something that a couple of weeks on this show, actually, you and Taylor both talked about, the idea that there's always a need, even after the giving season ends, to do something, and you know, this is just one particular way that someone's trying to help.
Well, yeah, and it doesn't need to be an ongoing thing. I think it's beneficial if you happen to be walking down the street and somebody asks you for change or whatever, to have a conversation with them because it's easy to remove the human face from the homelessness issue, and when you start having those conversations with people. Like they're actually people because they are. I think you can break through that, and you can understand a little better the factors that contribute to this issue. You can understand that they're not all drug addicts who are mentally ill. Some of them are just down on their luck. There's a whole variety of stories that I think the more of them that you hear, the more people you talk to in that sort of situation, the better you understand all the complexity. Of the factors that contribute to this issue in the city.
Taylor Stevens?
And on that point, I wanted to read a quote quickly from Jesse Campbell, formerly homeless man, who now works alongside Chase and Josh. He runs kind of a program where they take people experiencing homelessness fishing. And he talked about feeling forgotten by society when he was homeless. He said, "You will visually watch people turn their head the opposite direction of you so there's no eye contact. People are so uncomfortable to see sorrow or to see people hurt, or they don't know how to serve, they don't know how to give back, they don't know how to make a change." So that idea came out in a lot of conversations I had with people who are experiencing homelessness or have experienced homelessness, that, you know, just a simple hello can, you know, recognize someone's humanity and kind of help them feel connected to the rest of the community when they're going through a really tough time in life.
Well, it's a pretty inspiring story. I mean, there's a message from the 10-year-old Chase in the story that says we're all equal. And you can find Taylor Stevens' reporting on both of the topics we've been discussing so far on the show at sltrib.com. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll turn to some changes in health trends for Utahns over the past year. And we'll also talk about the transition taking place next week in the Salt Lake City Mayor's Office. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Jessica Miller and Taylor Stevens, and news columnist Robert Gerke. This is our Friday morning news roundup. You can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255 or tweet to @KCPW. Jessica Miller, bringing you into the conversation now. You this week wrote a story that looks back at the past decade of this is part of coverage the Tribune has been engaged in that examines how Utah changed in the 2010s. Your particular focus was how was the health trends in Utah, and you identified five trends that defined the decade. And maybe I'll just have you name them first, and then we can kind of pick them apart one by one. What are the five trends?
So once I got this assignment, I called the Department of Health because this isn't something I normally cover, and I just had to ask them, what are the trends of the last decade? And so they identified a few things for me. And so what we settled on was number of teens who are vaping, the suicide rates, drug overdose deaths, the STD rates, and then the number of Utahns who were uninsured, who don't have health insurance.
Okay, well let's
break it down.
Let's break it down. Why did so you called the health department and they gave you this list, but so why vaping? Why is that an important health story over the past decade?
Well, I think, you know, even 10 years ago, was vaping even a thing? I'm not quite sure. But the health department started asking teens in 2011 about vaping with the survey that they do in middle school every other year, where they ask kids about, you know, their alcohol use, tobacco use, things of that nature. So they started asking youth about vaping in 2011. Back then, 1.9% self-reported that they used e-cigarettes. And this year, that number had jumped to 12.4%. So it's been quite the increase in the last 10 years of the number of youth who are trying out e-cigarettes and other vaping-type products.
And I imagine with the just sort of the growth in that particular industry as well. Although then towards the end of the of that decade, we saw this very specific health problem related to vaping.
Right, exactly. Yeah, this is all coming out as, you know, in those last couple of months, there's been all these illnesses, lung-related illnesses connected to vaping. I think now they've kind of settled on the Department of Health has urged people to stop vaping THC specifically. That's been linked to some of these vaping-related injuries. But there's been one death in Utah vaping-related and 115 lung injury reports. So yeah, this is definitely an area where the health department is asking people to not vape until we kind of figure out whether this is actually a safe alternative to tobacco or not.
Okay, well, we're going to move on to other parts of the picking these apart, but I want to bring in Robert Grickey for just a second, the news columnist, and we won't do this for every individual trend, but just on vaping, I mean, the idea that it's new and people jumped on board and it was sort of seen as a way to get out of smoking, yeah. But now we're finding, of course, that it has its own problems.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty clear that vaping is not good for you, especially if you're a teenager and you shouldn't do it. And it has been fairly alarming to see some of the trend that has developed with the increase in teen vaping, and also the marketing tactics that a lot of these companies are using. Now they're under a lot of pressure. Obviously, Juul has pulled a lot of its flavored e-liquids. There was news yesterday that the federal government's going to propose banning the flavored e-liquids. And another thing that the United States hasn't really looked at yet is limiting the concentrations of these. That in Europe, the e-liquids are a lot milder, a lot less concentrated than they are here. Here they're sort of rocket powered. In terms of the nicotine content. Mm-hmm. And that's probably something worth looking at as well.
Okay. Well, let's move on to the second trend. And this is a steady rise through the decade, Jessica, in the number of Utahns who have died by suicide. And maybe you can sort of just, what are the numbers there?
Yeah, I think this is something we talk about a lot in the news. So it's probably not unsurprising to see that Utah's suicide rate has continued to rise over the last decade. In 2010, there were 466 Utahns who died by suicide, which was a rate of about 20.6 per 100,000 people. And then that number has just increased year by year. And then in 2018, there were 666 deaths, which is a rate of 25.4. So Utah has the sixth highest suicide rate in the nation. But this year, in November, state officials said that the year-to-year rate has actually decreased this year. So the trend might be reversing itself, but usually you have to take like 3 years to call it a trend. You know, just having a single year of a downward number of suicides doesn't necessarily, it's not statistically significant at this point.
Do state officials say there's any other reason to think that, you know, there might be a movement in that direction? I mean, are there other reasons for hope, I guess, is the question that I'm
I mean, I think we've seen the last couple of years, there's been improved coordination between, you know, healthcare workers and schools and state agencies to kind of provide more mental health services to people. We've seen the legislature providing funding for officials to kind of help make this a more like unified strategy, recognizing this is a problem and trying to find other ways to help get that number lower.
Hmm. I'm going to mention that there's the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, which provides 24-hour support, and the number is 1-800-273-8255. Generally, when we discuss suicide on this show or on the radio in general, we mention that. So if you or people you know are at risk of self-harm, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, again, 800-273-8255. Robert Grickey,
just want to jump in and sort of focus on some of the really positive steps the state's taken in terms of trying to combat suicide. Free gun locks, encouraging an educational campaign about some of the resources that are available, expanded mental health treatment, trying to get more counselors into schools to try to, nip some of this in the bud, if you will. And it's ongoing. And as Jessica said, it's too early to tell if it's actually changed the trajectory, but it certainly hasn't hurt, I don't think. And hopefully we're seeing the first year of many where we're seeing a downward trend on this.
Why? I mean, why sixth in the nation? Is there any specific? Is it that that's too hard to disentangle? I'm sure. And
oh how no, long it's a good question, but it's very complicated. And I think we've only got about 40 minutes left. So, but there's some research, some really interesting research about the altitude, the effect that altitude plays on depression. And then there's the access to firearms that is, you know, we've got a high rate of firearm ownership, which is that's the most common means of actually of killing oneself. And so but it's a complicated matter. Yeah.
OK, let's continue on with the health trends of the past decade. Mm-hmm. And Jessica Miller, third on your list, a substantial rise in the use of methamphetamines, a small dip at the same time in opioid use. Or maybe that's in fatalities, actually, in
yes,
overdose.
Yes, we're talking overdoses here. Yeah, this was probably one of the more interesting data sets that we found was, you know, we talk a lot about prescription opioid overdoses, and that's kind of like the billboards that you see, and, you know, everyone's talking about this opioid crisis that we have. But looking at the data, meth is actually, like, made a huge rise in contributing to overdose deaths in the last 10 years. Opioid-related deaths have kind of remained steady. They're still higher than meth. I mean, they're definitely killing more people, but there's just been this huge spike of meth-related overdose deaths. It's more than doubled in the past 5 years. It was like 31 deaths in 2010 to 217 in 2018. So there's been a real big increase.
A part of your story is that a big factor here might just be simple market forces, that it's cheaper.
Exactly. Yeah. It's about a tenth of the cost now than it was in the early 2000s. So there are other drugs, cocaine, things like that are more expensive than meth. And so it's easier to get. It's a cheaper drug.
Okay. Gerke, I'm going to have you wait. We're going to march forward into other trends. The next one on your list, Jessica, is that sexually transmitted diseases became much more common in Utah over the past decade. What's the data there?
So the state has seen a spike in sexually transmitted diseases, particularly chlamydia and gonorrhea. There's definitely more chlamydia, people infected with chlamydia compared to gonorrhea. There's 240 cases per 100,000 people in 2010. That rate for chlamydia rose to 333 by 2018. But gonorrhea was less prevalent, but that rate had an 834% increase from 2010 to 2018. So there's a huge rise in reported cases of gonorrhea in the last decade.
Why?
you know, a lot of what they're saying is that there could be higher numbers just because there's more sensitive diagnostic testing now.
Okay.
So we're just testing for it more. And the reporting process has been improving. But I think that it's still startling to a lot of people that the rates are this high. Mm. The Salt Lake County Health Director said over the summer that these rates lead him to believe that Utah's approach to sex education in schools just isn't working, that there should be something else than what we have right now.
So, and this is County Health Department Director Gary Edwards, mm-hmm, saying that STD education is a big part of the problem. Robert Gerke, do you want to weigh in on that?
Oh, I just wanted to highlight one stat that came out about on this issue is that I believe Utah County had more diagnosed cases of chlamydia than the flu last year, which is kind of mind-boggling when you think about it, in Utah County of all places. So this is a serious issue. There's something wrong here, and there's something that, you know, we could probably be doing differently to address that.
I remember for a time we were seeing reports that app-based dating, like, you know, things like Tinder, was maybe contributing to the rates of STDs in the state of Utah.
Maybe they need like a blue check, like you get on Twitter. You're certified clean, I guess.
Know.
Yeah, I don't know.
Robert Gerke, news columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune. Okay, well, let's finally turn to the last health trend of the past decade that you identified, or that maybe the health department identified when you called them up.
Yeah.
Which is health coverage. More Utahns have it than did before the decade began. By what sort of a margin, Jessica? Like, how big is that difference?
So in 2010, so this is a the census is American Community Survey. This is where this data is pulled from.
Okay.
And so in 2010, 15.5% of the survey respondents in Utah said that they didn't have health insurance. And then 2017, which was the latest available data, 8.7% said they weren't insured. So that number, unlike all the other health data where everything is going like up, this is the one where it's been going down, that there are more Utahns who have health insurance, which is interesting because this all, of course, was going on with the backdrop of the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid expansion and all of that healthcare related politics.
So, okay, yeah, right. There was politics around that. And a big sort of coda to that story is something that happened at the turn of the year, right? You know, right with the launch of this year, 2 days ago, 3 days ago. Full Medicaid expansion is now a reality in Utah,
mm-hmm.
with some strings attached. What are those strings and who's eligible for this?
So the strings attached with that is that there is a work requirement that's attached to this. So if you don't have a certain exemption, you have to go through training and I think fill out a certain number of job applications in order to be eligible for Medicaid. And so this looks like the full expansion means that anyone earning less than 138% of the federal poverty level, which is about $17,000 for an individual yearly, is now eligible for Medicaid.
Okay. News columnist Robert Gerke, a decade of intriguing health-related news. That last item seems like the sort of coup de grace of this topic. What's your take on the fact that we do now finally have, and the fact that there's been a big fight going on, a full Medicaid expansion?
I mean, this has been years and years in the making. And I thought it was kind of an interesting story. When the word came down, as I wrote in my column last week about this, when word came down that the federal government was going to approve this full expansion, Gary Herbert was at Crossroads Urban Center passing out holiday turkeys, right? And it was on Christmas Eve. And one of the guys who works there, one of the advocates, thanked him for his work in trying to, you know, get Medicaid expanded. And he said, well, if only if the legislature had done this, adopted his Help the Utah plan 5 years ago. And that's the real truth of it, because 5 years ago, or 6 years ago now, almost, the governor was proposing this Help the Utah plan, which is very similar to what ultimately was approved, out of the work requirement, the expansion, full expansion up to 138%. All of this were things the governor proposed in 2014. And so it took, again, almost 6 years to finally get this across the line because the legislature was so resistant about it. It took the people of Utah through this initiative process to actually get this done. And it's unfortunate. There's two ways of looking at it. There's the dollars we spent. By an estimation by Families USA, it's a national advocacy group. The state spent about $500 million more in 2019, covering fewer people than could have qualified for full Medicaid expansion under a scaled back plan that the legislature adopted, trying to get approval of this of a larger reimbursement from the federal government. So they lost about $500 million there in 2019, stretched over the 6 years from the time Utah could have been eligible for full Medicaid expansion had they just adopted it. It was over $5.5 billion that the state gave up basically in Medicaid dollars. And then there's the human toll of it. As Jessica mentioned, that we've seen the numbers of people who are uninsured go down over the last decade, but we could have seen that coming down faster, sooner, and more people getting coverage, more people getting the treatment that they needed.
Is it going to stick around? I mean, here's the question that I have is now that it's happened and this federal waiver, because there was a waiver required for the work requirement portion of Medicaid. I mean, is it here to stay?
It seems to be going in that direction, to be honest. The state is still looking for some additional flexibility, shall we call it, in the way it administers the program. But for now, it's here, and for the foreseeable future, it's here. They're encouraging people to get signed up for it. The numbers for the first year it's been in place, the scaled back version that I mentioned, in 2019, the enrollment was about half of what they had projected it to be. People are not signing up for it as quickly as they hoped. They're hoping now with this broader expansion that we'll actually see more people thinking that they are recognizing that they probably qualify for this and getting signed up and getting the healthcare they need.
Okay. That is Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Gerke. We're actually going to take another quick break in the show, and then we'll turn to a change in transition at the mayor's office and also some predictions for the future of the news here on Behind the Headlines. And you're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in just a minute.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough, joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Taylor Stevens, Jessica Miller, and Robert Gerke. It's our Friday morning news roundup, and you can weigh in on what you've been hearing by calling 801-355-8255, or again, you can tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. And Taylor Stevens, coming back to you before we turn to some predictions for the coming news year. This is some very local politics news. On Monday, there's a transition going on at the helm of Salt Lake City. We're going to have a new mayor. Is that when the actual, official turnover of power, or whatever you want to call it, takes place, is on Monday?
Yep. Oath of office happens on Monday, not only for the new mayor, but for the new council members. Two are incumbents and a third brand new council member. So there will be kind of some changing leadership in Salt Lake City, replacing outgoing mayor Jackie Biskupski, who served one term.
Do we have a handle on how big of a change in terms of the positions in the mayor's office there will be? I know that at the outset of Jackie Biskupski's administration, she asked for the resignations of a number of department heads and then rehired people. What's going on in terms of how incoming mayor Aaron Mendenhall will handle that part of the transition?
Yeah, Mendenhall has pledged not to request the blanket resignation of every one of those positions as Jackie Biskupski did when she took office. However, there will be shakeups in leadership, as there is with any new administration. So we're hearing, a few people who know they're no longer going to be employed. And I think that there is some trepidation as people sort of wait to see what's going to happen. But, as far as what we've heard so far, it doesn't sound like super major shakeups, but we will be kind of keeping an eye on that to see what happens next.
You also reported that the incoming mayor is holding community meetings, or holding meetings at office hours, I guess is the idea, for residents to come and talk to her, and that she pledged to keep doing that.
Yeah, so she did four office hour sessions, two on weeknights after 5 p.m. and two on Saturdays. And that was part of her transition committee and her sort of desire to engage the community and get their feedback on what they want to see out of the new administration. She told me that when she started doing those, she didn't really anticipate that she would continue them. However, she's planning, and she didn't say, how frequently she's going to see what her schedule looks like, I think, but she plans to continue to hold those meetings, and she plans to continue to hold them at city libraries. Mayor Biskupski did hold some kind of office hours quarterly, 5 minutes with the mayor. And Aaron, what she wants to do is have those be a little bit more frequent, I think, and also to hold them at the libraries because she thinks that's more accessible, that, people are maybe more familiar and comfortable going to their library than going to City Hall, where you kind of walk in and you're surrounded by, police at the front desk, and she thinks it'll just be more accessible to people to come in and talk to her.
Well, you have to wonder if she's just going to see the same people over and over again at those libraries. But Robert Gerke, just as before we head into the final story that we'll cover, which is you're peering into the mists. Do you want to talk about this transition and the legacy versus what's about to happen? The legacy of Mayor Jackie Biskupski versus where the city's headed. I mean, any comments yet?
Well, I think
that could be part of your predictions.
It's a little early to tell where the Mendenhall administration is going to end up. But I think she did learn some important lessons from the mistakes that Jackie made when she took office 4 years ago. The wholesale purge doesn't work, and it makes it difficult for you. It's bad for morale, for one thing, but it also makes it difficult for you to get moving as the new mayor. You've got to start from zero. And so she's kind of trying to maintain some of the momentum as they change over from one administration to the other. I think the continuation of the listening office hours is good. And I think when and where and how you listen to people is as important as listening to people generally. So going out to these communities, doing it at the libraries, doing it at times where people, you know, not in the middle of the day, doing it after work and on Saturdays is good. And so I think, you know, these are positive steps. It remains to be seen, obviously, where the administration goes. But I think these are good signs.
Taylor Stevens, just before we head to Robert Gerke, and our final segment of the show as well. Are you expecting any sort of big changes in terms of policies on any specific large big items like homelessness or the Inland Port or any of the other topics that have kind of defined the past little while in Salt Lake City government and politics?
So she's pledged to take some immediate steps on air quality, which I believe we've talked about on this show before. Her transition committee on Monday released 131 pages of recommendations on areas ranging from sustainability to equity and inclusion. And so I've read through those and kind of know what their recommendations are. And we're meeting with the mayor-elect later today to find out what of those recommendations she plans to implement. So we'll have more information on that this weekend.
Okay. That's Salt Lake Tribune reporter Taylor Stevens. And we are going to now turn to columnist Robert Gerke and some crystal gazing or tea leaf reading that he did, or maybe you examined the entrails of birds. I don't know what method you used.
It's a combination. Yeah.
But you wrote a column with some predictions about the coming year's news cycle. You started, though, with the fact that you did the same thing at the end of last year and that you got, or at the beginning of this year, I guess, or 2019, I'm getting confused.
In early January 2019.
Do you want to run through what was your biggest miss last year, Gerke?
Well, I think I said at this time last year that we were going to be preparing for Mayor Jim DeBacchus's first term in office. And obviously, it's sort of, the thing I like about that prediction is there were so many things that changed in that mayor's race in 2019 that really would have been difficult to, you know, maybe if I actually had powers of prophecy, if I actually had this Nostradamus ability, but we didn't see the mayor Biskupski stepping aside, and we didn't see Aaron Mendenhall or Luz Escamilla getting into the race. Jim looked like a juggernaut in January of 2019, and he looked like the most likely candidate, and obviously, you know, that's not how it played out.
Another one that you got wrong had to do with, well, I mean, well,
we're just going to focus on things I got wrong.
Yeah, this is what we're going to do. Well, I want to lay out the fact that, you know, maybe you might have a flawed method here, but that you predicted that former House Speaker Greg Hughes would by now be in the governor's race and would have a sort of commanding lead.
Yeah, well, he and Spencer Cox would be distancing themselves from the field, that they would be pulling away. Hughes is going to get into the race next week. And we had Thomas Wright, a former Republican chair, who got in yesterday. But, you know, I couldn't have seen, again, you know, Ambassador/Governor John Huntsman coming back from Russia to try to run for governor again. That was sort of unexpected and has thrown a big wrinkle into the works. And the fact that Rob Bishop might or might not get into the race could complicate things further. So, you know, it's imperfect. The magic eight ball is not always right.
All right, well, let's move into the predictions that you made for the coming year. And one of them in particular has to do with election-related predictions.
And this, a lot of election stuff.
Yeah, this one will rankle some listeners. I think it's the re-election of President Donald Trump. That's something you predict for 2020.
Yeah, and it seems a little absurd, I guess, that I wrote a few weeks ago that he could be the first president to be impeached and then re-elected. It's, you know, obviously he's been impeached, so that's the second piece of that we're talking about now. As bad as the news has been for him, as difficult as the year was in terms of the you know, everything that transpired with Ukraine and the Mueller report and everything like that, his base is solid, and they're going to come out and vote for him. And so what it, you know, while he's unpopular nationally in the few battleground states that actually determined the next president, he's still polling pretty even with he's polling ahead of Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders and Pete Buttigieg, and he's polling behind but close to Biden in most of those key battleground states. And so barring some sort of big collapse in the economy or maybe a war like we might be having with Iran, given the news of the past 24 hours, I think it's probably more likely than not, but just barely more likely than not, that he'll lose the popular vote but still win the Electoral College in another term.
Getting kind of meta here, do you ever worry that, you know, talking about it might make it true?
I'm putting it out in the universe.
Right, or that some voters are swayed by the concept that a person is or isn't electable, and then you write a column, and a bunch of others do too, predicting that outcome, and then since you've said it, they believe it enough to kind of make it happen. You know, I mean, this is maybe
I don't know that my column is going to necessarily determine the outcome of the presidential election. I like to think it might, but, you know, I guess the butterfly flapping its wings can cause a tsunami, and, you know, No, I mean, I think it's important to talk about. And I think as we go into a presidential election, electability is something you've got to consider, you know. Sure, you people should stick to their principles and stick to what they believe and vote for the candidate they believe in. But they, if Democrats and independents who lean that way want to defeat Donald Trump, that's something that they have to take into consideration.
All right. And again, this is an exercise in fortune telling by news columnist Robert Gerke. Another prediction that you made for the coming news year had to do with the fourth district, Utah's fourth congressional district election. What was your prediction there?
Well, I mean, the 4th District is always a fun one to watch. Some national publications have said it's the most competitive race in the country this year in the House, and it's a toss-up in other, you know, in pretty much every respect. Ben McAdams is seen as a little bit vulnerable, perhaps, because of his impeachment vote in a Republican-leaning district. It's changed hands from Democrat to Republican, and then Republican back to Democrat in just the last decade, twice by less than 800 votes. And so it's always going to be a close race. I think McAdams holds on to win, and I don't think the impeachment hurts him as much as some might think, because I think the people who were going to vote based on his vote on impeachment, vote against him based on his vote on impeachment, were probably not going to vote for him anyway. And Trump remains unpopular, very unpopular in the 4th District. And his opposition at this point, with State Senator Dan Hemmert getting out of the race, you've got Kim Coleman, Jay McFarlane, Burgess Owens, Kathleen Anderson, maybe not the more well-known, well-financed candidates that the party maybe would want to have running against him. So I think McAdams has done some things to sort of solidify his base, and I think he holds on to win. But again, it's going to be, I wouldn't be surprised again if it's right around 800 votes, so it's going to be a tight one.
There's a lot more predictions that you made. One has to do with sort of a continuation of a trend from last year, which was the Utah State Legislature changing some ballot initiatives passed by voters. There's one that that kind of so far has avoided being tampered with. You predict that it will be tampered with.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Better Boundaries initiative is obviously, they kind of revised or rewrote the medical marijuana one. They rewrote the Medicaid expansion initiative. They hadn't messed with the Better Boundaries, which creates an independent redistricting commission. The clock's ticking on that, right? Because we're going to be starting the next census. We're going to have to go through the redistricting process in 2021. I think there had been some hope, perhaps, that the Supreme Court was going to invalidate some of these independent redistricting commissions or weigh in and give some guidance, but they didn't do that. So now I think it's going to fall to the legislature to perhaps try to tinker with this a little bit. Keep in mind, the redistricting commission is only advisory anyway, so they're not exactly, they aren't drawing the boundaries. They're recommending some boundaries that the legislature can accept or reject. But I think they're going to try to take some, even the few teeth that this commission has, I think they're going to try to pull some of those in the coming session.
Tribune columnist Robert Gerke with his predictions. And there's more in his article at sltrib.com on the coming year. However, we are at the end of the show and need to turn now to our final segment, the underplayed stories of the week. And Taylor Stevens, the first week of the new year, what was your pick for underplayed story?
So, yeah, we entered 2019 with a lot of fear about the new blood alcohol limit going from 0.08 to 0.05. And Kathy Stevenson, our food and alcohol reporter, has some information that the number of DUI, I believe it's arrests, has kind of stayed stagnant, sort of stayed the same as last year. So a little unexpected, and she has some more information on why.
You can check that out at sltrib.com. It was a sort of, there was an uptick at the beginning of the year, but through the year it didn't hold, that trend didn't hold, and it's the same as it was the year before. Jessica Miller, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
I'm going to pick Sarah Weber's story roundup she did about the 22 stories from 2019 that are the unique to Utah stories. And it, you know, ranges from a Mormon millionaire matchmaker to that weird video of Mitt Romney blowing out his birthday candles. And there was one about a, you know, woman being charged with lewdness for being topless in her own home. So if you want to just reminisce about everything that was so Utah this year, that is a great story to do that.
The most Utah stories of the year is Jessica Miller's pick. Robert Gerke, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
Peggy Fletcher Stack, I guess this one goes back to, well, early in the week, over the weekend, had a profile of Frans Davis, who's retiring after, I can't remember how many years, decades, yeah, as the reverend of the Calvary Baptist Church. Frans was a civil rights icon. He marched with Martin Luther King in Selma, has led the Calvary Baptist Church here for, as I said, for decades. He's been a voice for equality and justice in the state, and I think he's going to be missed. It's well worth taking some time to read that.
Peggy Fletcher Stack's profile of the Reverend Frans Davis at sltrib.com. For my part, I'm going to go with an old sign once again coming back. This is the Salt Lake Costume sign at 11th East and 1700 South, a neighborhood that's not far from where I grew up is getting its sign back after a change in ordinance, I think. Taylor Stevens, you could fill me in on this, actually, for why this happened. But this old sign of a knight on a steed is coming back.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting story about the unintended consequences of a policy decision. An old ordinance required any changes to a sign. If it was taken down, it couldn't be put back up. So the old Sputnik sign on 21st, they had to repair like 40 feet in the air. And so a lot of these signs were being lost to age. So check it out,
sltrib.com. I'm gonna have to cut you off there, Taylor Stevens. That does it for this edition of Behind the Headlines, but thanks very much to Robert Gerke, Jessica Miller, and Taylor Stevens, all from the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And you can find podcasts of the show at kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. Until next week, have a great, happy new year.